I think asking for feedback, getting feedback, and then not graciously recognizing that person's perspective and just sort of, if it's not something you like, moving on is a really easy way to actually have a negative effect on that advisor relationship. So I think following through with the advisors, and like you said, when, if done correctly, your advisors are very likely going to be your earliest customers because they feel that they've been involved in making the product. They've had skin in the game, that they know you beyond just the product you're trying to sell them. They believe in you as entrepreneurs and they're willing to help you. And certainly if, as long as you're talking to the right advisors and they are in line with who you're ultimately trying to commercialize your product with, it should very seamlessly sort of translate into your first commercial adopters.
And now from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
Our guest today is Jason Bellis, co-founder and chief customer officer of Echo, a digital health company applying machine learning to cardiac screening and monitoring. Echo uses an FDA-cleared platform of devices, telehealth software, and disease detection algorithms to improve screening for cardiopulmonary disease in more than 4,000 hospitals. In this episode, Jason tells the story of how he co-founded Echo while still an undergraduate student at UC Berkeley. He gives tips on how to get your foot in the door, how to cultivate advisor relationships, and why it's important to invest in telehealth infrastructure. Here's that conversation. Well, welcome, Jason. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me. This is so exciting.
Yeah. So as you know, I sat down with Connor Landgraf, your co-founder, a few weeks ago. We talked about his journey. And today I'm so excited to have you here for you to share with us your journey and your story. So tell us, how did you and Connor team up for Echo?
Connor and I actually met as undergrads at UC Berkeley. We were both super interested in student government. At the time, I was in the business school at Haas School of Business, and Connor was getting his bioengineering undergrad degree, and then ultimately he got his master's degree there as well. And when Connor had the idea for a smart stethoscope, he said, hey, you know, can you help me build out a marketing plan and a preliminary business plan that we could use for our angel pitch decks? Was super interested in the high-level challenge of reinventing the stethoscope and how we screen for heart disease. And so I was all in and excited to join him in the project. And 7 years later, we're still going. So
yeah.
Little did we know at the time. But it's been an incredible journey. I couldn't ask for a better co-founder, and he really is a healthcare visionary. So I'm excited to follow in his footsteps here on the podcast.
Oh, great. So you are not part of the project of his capstone project?
I was not, no. So there was it was part of his senior thesis capstone project. And right after that, the summer after that, he decided to keep it going. He knew there was an idea that probably made sense to look at beyond the scope of just a class project, which I'm very glad he did. And that's when he pulled me in.
So what were you doing at that time for you to jump ship?
Yeah. So, well, funny enough, for those in the Berkeley ecosystem, you know how big student government is on campus. So I was actually running to be student body president, which Connor was the year before, and I lost.
Do you lose to him or do you lose it to other people?
I didn't lose to Connor. No, so Connor was the president the year before. I was kind of running to be his successor. And I lost by a really narrow margin. And I was like, Connor, I don't know what I'm going to do my senior year because I have left a huge gap in my schedule open for this. And I had been really interested in healthcare policy, worked for a government relations consulting firm in DC that was really involved in writing the Affordable Care Act. At the time, this was 2014, you know, so not that long before. And he pitched me the idea for Echo, and I had a huge gap in my schedule, and I was like, let's do it. So I'm, you know, sometimes life works out for a reason. I was really upset to lose the election, but found something, I would say a higher calling, which I'm really glad that I was able to pursue.
Isn't it funny? I thought we always were disappointed when things did not work out the way we wanted. but there's always another thing.
Yes. And the relationships we make along the way, you know, you never know that the person you're going to meet in student government is going to be the person that you end up founding your company with and working side by side for nearly a decade. So it's just amazing.
Yeah. So at that time, you were on your last year before you graduated. And so you're still used to eating ramen every day.
Yes. Yes. We did not have a hard adjustment to the scrappy founder life because we were already scrappy students. But yes, we started off working in Skydeck, which is it was in the early days of Skydeck, the UC Berkeley accelerator, and had our mm-hmm. two desks side by side and started to build the team in that penthouse suite in downtown Berkeley, which couldn't be a more inspiring place to like sit and work out of as you're starting to build a company. And I just have amazing memories of finishing class and then hopping on my scooter, running down to Skydeck and spending another 6-8 hours a day working on Echo. And it didn't feel like work though. It felt like, you know, something we were passionate about.
Yeah. So what made that relationship work? I mean, you spent a lot of time together and that can be challenging for some, but can be also very productive for others. Obviously, in your case, it's pretty productive.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, my relationship with Connor, it really started out with, we both shared a really similar intellectual kind of excitement around and really passion for this problem of how cardiac disease was broken. And I think sort of that shared interest and that shared kind of momentum to try to tackle that was really what brought us together beyond just being friends. And I really admire the guy. I mean, from what he's able to do from a biomedical engineering perspective and building out our prototypes, and he's a self-taught computer software developer. And so he was really involved in building out our preliminary algorithms and mobile apps. You don't meet very many people who have that sort of multidimensionality to them. And he's, you know, incredibly well-spoken and able to sort of get up on a stage and share the message. And so I knew that sort of there was a really powerful combination with what I could bring to the table, which was helping build out the marketing and the marketing plan and the sales plan. And frankly, what I was focused on in the very early days was talking to every cardiologist and every GP that I could and getting their feedback and consolidating that into some key product takeaways and building our early advisory board, which served to be really instrumental in our success. So we complemented each other really well.
Yeah, obviously, I mean, from your stories, like you also bring something that's different that filled the role that it was not available at that time. And do you guys have like a huddle? It's like, okay, this is the carve out, the area that you focused on, so that there's no confusion. That's nobody, because when you're only two of you, you need to make sure that things are more efficient.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we also had a third co-founder and have a third co-founder, Tyler, and he was a computer scientist. So he very quickly sort of took ownership of the mobile app development and the software development. Connor was CEO. And I think it's really important when you have multiple co-founders to have one CEO. You know, you can't have three CEOs and function effectively as an organization. So even though you all share that co-founder title, someone needs to be at the helm and really kind of bringing the team together and leading the team. And Connor stepped into that role. And then I really ran the sort of commercial side of the business, everything from the business plan modeling all the way to securing our early advisors and getting out in the field and talking and hopefully starting to prep the market for when we were going to launch our first product, which at the time was about 18 months away when we graduated.
Looking back at that moment when you just started, your background was not in healthcare and you went to meet with a lot of the cardiologists who are very busy. Probably they make you showed up in their office at 6 a.m.
Yes.
And what are the things that you need to do to prepare for that meeting? I'm just thinking about, you know, lesson learned that you can provide to other entrepreneurs who are passionate in certain disease area that they want to solve the problem, but then they don't have that kind of background.
I think that's a great question. You know, I can share from my experience when we became fascinated by the idea of building an AI-powered stethoscope and sort of looked at what the standard of care was today, which was using a rubber tube with a metal chest piece, and ultimately the downstream negative effects of the lack of effective frontline screening. We were fortunate in that there was a pretty decent body of literature from the previous 20, 30 years on the importance of auscultation. Auscultation is the listening of heart and lung sound. So the important role that the stethoscope plays and how fallible it is when we're solely reliant on the human ear and the impacts that we see downstream. And so what we did was actually pull together, the library of those studies and published papers and built a contact list of the authors of those papers. And when you contact an esteemed cardiologist at an academic research institution and say, hey, I read your paper and you've inspired me to look into this further, can I have 20 minutes of your time to A, get your feedback on what we're thinking of building, which is kind of the next step from what you've identified as the problem, which is the solution, and it's a smart stethoscope. And you're also a practicing provider. Can we get your feedback on how this would integrate into your workflow? And it comes from a berkeley.edu or UCSF.edu email address. People want to help. And I think as long as you go into the room not asking them for anything other than their feedback and their guidance, not trying to sell them something, we were just blown away by the feedback that we were able to get from industry-leading cardiologists and their willingness to carve out the time, be it was 6 a.m., but we were able to get in the door.
Yeah, that's good. And just for the listener, just to make sure that people know what Echo is doing, do you mind? Can you tell us, what does Echo do?
Yeah, so Echo is a cardiac screening and monitoring company. We're based in Oakland, but came out of the UC Berkeley Accelerator. And we help clinicians on the front lines of care detect and ultimately monitor cardiopulmonary disease using the stethoscope, which is the icon of medicine. It's an incredibly low-cost, powerful tool, and it can be used pretty much on every patient in every physical exam. What many of us know about the stethoscope is that it's a pretty basic tool, and it relies on the human ear to be able to suss out very subtle abnormalities between a normal heart sound and an abnormal or pathologic heart sound. And unfortunately, because of the subtle nuances and the fallibility of the human ear, providers aren't able to hear or diagnose a lot of early signs of cardiac disease that they would be able to if they had a stethoscope that could help them identify those conditions. So if you think of kind of a spectrum of providers, you have the cardiologist on one end who is amazing at being able to detect abnormalities. And then you have providers who are trained, cross-trained on so many different specialties that they're really not experts on heart sounds and lung sounds. And as we know, heart disease is the number one killer in the world. Sadly, patients are often not diagnosed until they become symptomatic or much further in their disease cycle. So our whole mission with Echo was if we could help clinicians detect disease earlier, with an AI-powered stethoscope, we could get patients into the pipeline of care faster and hopefully improve their outcomes. And so we've built the first FDA-cleared platform that combines digital stethoscopes with point-of-care screening software and AI to help clinicians do what they do best, which is identify problems early and get patients into the right pipeline of care.
And you said earlier that you're really much, very much interested in a cardiovascular disease. Is there a reason why?
I don't have thankfully, don't have a kind of a personal negative experience with someone in my family or close to me suffering from cardiovascular disease. As Connor shared sort of his vision for Echo with me, and as I looked deeper into the problem, when you look at statistics around kind of the underdiagnosis of structural heart disease at the front lines of care, where providers, they're doing the best they can, but, potentially missing 20 to 30% of potentially pathologic murmurs. I think for anyone that sort of gives you chills and to be able to think, especially back in 2014, when everything was becoming smart, smart doorbell, smart thermometer, smart, placemat, everything. Why don't we have a smart stethoscope? And then when you juxtapose that to heart disease being the number one killer, with 12 million patients in the U.S. suffering from chronic cardiovascular disease, it was it was a really big problem that we felt like we had a pretty attainable solution for. And so it just got us really excited to start working on it.
Yeah, I'm glad that you know, and I'm glad that you guys are working on something this important as well. One of the things that, you know, when you are like leading the marketing, the commercialization aspect of this technology, it's kind of unique in a way, like how your approach is. I've seen that you, in the beginning, you marketed to the medical students. And give us your thought process. Why was that the approach that you take on the first time? And of course, now it's kind of expanded and exploded.
Absolutely. Yeah, we did. In the very early days of Echo, we did a lot of work with medical schools and medical educators. And it was really a result of a study that we read that showed the sensitivity and specificity of clinicians over time decreasing pretty rapidly as an indicator that the skill of auscultation, the skill of listening to heart and lung sounds wasn't being adapted by this next generation of clinicians as effectively as the generation before them.
And why is that?
There's a lot of
make me worry. Those are my future doctors.
Yeah. You know, I think sort of the presence of more advanced screening tools like ultrasound and 12-lead EKG have in some ways served as a reason to invest less and less in stethoscope technology. But unfortunately, that kind of the progression of 12-lead and ultrasound technology has not made it into the primary care clinic. It has not made it into the retail clinic and the urgent care clinic. We're still reliant on the stethoscope. So there's been this huge acceleration in really more precise cardiovascular screening technology that has in the medical education space sort of taken precedence over learning how to use a stethoscope. But in actual clinical care today, it's the stethoscope that's on the front lines of care. You know, as a patient, I don't go into my doctor and they don't do an ultrasound on me every time I go in. So there's this gap that's developed. If you talk to a cardiologist who, you know, was trained 30 or 40 years ago, they have almost a musical ear that can differentiate really, really subtle abnormalities that this latest generation of cardiologists just have not had the opportunity to develop. So we got very interested in the idea of let's go right to the source and let's work with medical schools and programs to up-level training with our technology that allows the next generation to not only listen better, but to see what they're listening to capture what they're listening to, and also analyze what they're listening to. And I think as Apple kind of showed us in their educational strategy, you know, basically being on every major medical school campus bookstore, we feel like to really change the standard of care, we need to integrate this into medical education.
Was that Apple approach inspire you or just something that?
Yeah, Apple definitely inspired us. I think, you know, at the time we were college students and you looked around and everyone was using a Mac. And Apple had just absolutely excelled at becoming the standard in the education space and that building sort of a next generation of brand loyalists. And because they had a phenomenal product, but we felt like it was a great opportunity to get in with the next generation of clinicians by working directly with medical schools.
What was the challenge for you guys at that time to sell it to the medical students? Like, you know, engaging all that university is not an easy task either.
Yes. So we did a couple of partnerships where we actually would give the product away to really study the impact that it had on medical education. So that was one of the ways that we were able to collect data to show that, you know, it improved the ability to listen to heart and lung sounds and allowed students to engage with the sounds more meaningfully. We did sell into med schools for, I would say, some of our early adopters were medical school educators. But I have to admit, we it's very hard selling into medical schools and the budgets are very limited. So even if you have the best stethoscope, the reality is medical schools are operating on a shoestring budget. And so we also realized that while we needed to sort of make our technology available to medical students, we also needed to very quickly figure out our strategy for selling to private practices and health systems, because that's where a lot of the value creation was happening in the ability to detect disease earlier, get patients into the right pipeline of care. So from a sales perspective, I would say the majority of our sales very quickly began to come from the health system partners versus the medical schools.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rutnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping medtech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
And how do you, I'm just trying to think about, like, many of the doctors, especially the one who's established, like you said, they are trained better. So for how do you convince them that this is something that can help them? Because they might say, like, well, I got this. I know this. I've been doing this for years, and I know how to detect them early because I'm that good.
Absolutely. And for those people, we often say you probably don't need the product. I think for cardiologists who have that musically trained ear, their performance is about the same as our algorithm. Kind of the sensitivity and specificity of the AI we've trained meets that of a cardiologist for murmur detection and AFib detection. So what we really focus on in terms of who we work with and partner with are primarily providers further upstream on the front lines of care who don't have that musically trained ear. So your primary care providers, your physician assistants and nurse practitioners and nurses who are trained on such a broad range of topics that heart sounds and lung sounds is a very small portion of their overall training. And they're very often the first to admit that that is one of the hardest parts of their job. And if you could help them listen with greater clarity, identify if there's an abnormality into what in what they were listening to, they're all for it. I think what it ultimately comes down to is workflow. How do you integrate this type of decision support into the physical exam so it doesn't slow them down? Because that's also a big challenge, is they have a huge patient load and they're moving very quickly. And certainly, how do you make it affordable and scalable across the system? So that became more of the challenge, less so the pushback from providers saying, hey, we don't need this.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, you have to do a lot of listening and understanding so that what you deliver is aligned with what their financial need, obviously. And do you have any tips for companies who are trying to, I mean, it's not easy to get that first contract.
I think it's so critical that digital health, come any startup, actually get a representative advisory board that represents not only different kind of end user profiles. So for us, it was the different provider types, but also the kind of customer profiles of the system, the private practice, in some senses, the payer and the PMP, the pharmaceutical company. And our advisory board, very early on, we split between a commercial advisory board that really helped us figure out our go-to-market strategy and our medical advisory board. And I think many startups fear they may be too early to land the type of advisors that they want to land. And I think, kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier, I think if pitched the right way and you approach the right advisors as you really want their guidance and support, we were very pleasantly surprised at how willing people were to join our advisory board and work with us pretty intimately on our strategy.
I think that's it's, and if you listen to their feedback and the more enthusiastic they are in sharing their connection and their needs.
Correct.
I'm sure.
Yeah, and you can't get too attached to your model. You have to be willing to actually listen to their feedback, which is really important.
Right. And I often, sometimes people always say, like, well, you got all this different feedback from so many different directions, and some can be so different from the other. At the end of the day, you guys have to make that decision.
Correct. Yeah.
But I think communicating to the person who gave you that feedback in a way that they are heard and listened to, I think is so important as well.
Yeah, there's, I think asking for feedback, getting feedback, and then not graciously recognizing that person's perspective and just sort of, if it's not something you like, moving on is a really easy way to actually have a negative effect on that advisor relationship. So yeah. I think following through with the advisors, and like you said, when, if done correctly, your advisors are very likely going to be your earliest customers because they feel that they've been involved in making the product. They've had skin in the game, that they know you beyond just the product you're trying to sell them. They believe in you as entrepreneurs and they're willing to help you. And certainly if, as long as you're talking to the right advisors and they are in line with who you're ultimately trying to commercialize your product with, it should very seamlessly sort of translate into your first commercial adopters.
And then one of the things that I also found that with your technology now that you have gathered so many data and basically your business expanded beyond providing this smart stethoscope. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I'm so glad you asked that. So we started out with this very simple vision of a smart stethoscope for the front lines of care, but so much has happened in healthcare over the last 6-7 years, the first of which is telemedicine has just exploded. And the provider and the patient are very often not in the same room anymore. So when we think about telemedicine and the ability to deliver the same level of care that providers can deliver face-to-face, but now virtually, we not only need video conferencing, which is, you know, I'm sure I can speak from my perspective, I've used video visits more in the last year than I had in my entire life beforehand.
Isn't it great?
It's great. It's patients love it. The providers seem to really like it. But fortunately, you know, I'm healthy. And I think the what we're realizing and what providers are realizing are telemedicine, especially virtual video visits, works really well for healthy patients or for very acute illnesses. But if you're talking about chronic disease management and patients, you know, the millions of patients in the US that have heart disease or pulmonary disease, doing a video conference with a patient with heart failure isn't enough if you're trying to then use that to replace the physical exam. Right. We need tools that allow us to quote unquote go beyond video and give the patients the eyes and ear, give the provider the eyes and ears on the patient that they would have had they come into their office. And that's where Echo has played a huge role this last year by actually allowing clinicians, whether they're doing a visit between two locations, like an urgent care in a rural area and a health system, in a central hub at a health system, or direct to patient homes, our tool allows clinicians to actually send the stethoscope to the patient or to the provider who's with the patient, pair our stethoscope with our software, and start a live stream back to the listening consulting provider so that they can not only see the patient during the video call, but actually hear the heart sounds and lung sounds of the patient virtually to be able to emulate a complete physical exam over video, which is unlocks the ability to provide a whole new level of specialty care via telemedicine. So that's been keeping us really busy during COVID. We are now heavily investing in our telehealth infrastructure to be able to allow providers to do this telecardiology, telepulmonology, teleprimary care, where you go beyond video using our solution. So we've spun out a product that's specifically for telemedicine and at-home monitoring called Echo Home.
Does that mean, how does it work with the payers? Like, who's paying for that device?
It's a great question. So we've also seen, you know, in the last year post-COVID, a complete relaxation of the telemedicine reimbursement laws. So there's now parity to doing a virtual visit with a patient as it would have been had they come into the office. So the system, the health system, especially for their highest risk patients, are now more incentivized to be able to send peripherals like ARDS into the home. They also are able to tap into chronic care management CPT codes and remote patient monitoring codes for more asynchronous type of patient encounters. But we have been typically working with the health system, and very often the system is looking at their capitated patient population. If it's a traditional fee-for-service health system, their sickest patients that they're looking at reducing readmissions with, or are under a capitated model where it makes sense to send this technology into the patient's home to really focus on outcomes. And then we were able to work with ACOs and payers, or what I've been recently been hearing is payviders, who are interested in, you know, as the payer and the provider, making sure these patients can conduct very robust telemedicine visits from the comfort of their couch.
That's great. I think more empowering the patients also very, very helpful. I mean, I can imagine if I were the patient, I'd like to have that capability that I don't have to go park my car to see my doctor on a regular basis. What are the, you know, we're almost closer to our times. I just want to make sure that I capture some from you. What lessons you learned during this pandemic that kind of give you a different way of looking at operating a company and or starting a company or launching a new product?
Absolutely. Yeah. Operating a company, regardless, I would say just living during the pandemic, forget about even operating a company. I think we've all walked away with some really amazing insights about ourselves, about society. And there's so many, and we're still sort of reflecting on it right now. You know, one of them is sort of the capacity for healthcare to change on a dime. I think we took for granted that healthcare, we sort of became resigned to the fact that healthcare takes forever to change. But we saw an expansion in telemedicine and in the enablement of virtual care within 6 months that would have taken probably a decade to transpire. And certainly an exogenous shock caused it, but the ability for the system to change on a dime was remarkable to observe, and now has proven that it's possible. I think the resiliency of our customer base, you know, we are providing a tool that helps clinicians listen to lung sounds and heart sounds. And in a pandemic that had an acute impact on pulmonary function, that tool became really, really important to the delivery of care. And so our team, you know, 130 employees at Echo, became beyond inspired by our customer base of 80,000 clinicians, many of whom are frontline COVID warriors. You know, we're in the ICUs, we're standing up virtual care practices within 3 days. And so sort of we always respected our customer base and they were always our heroes, but to really see them put the cape on in the last year has just been an absolute eye-opening experience for us. And I think we've become closer to our customers than we've ever been before. And then I think, you know, from a team perspective, our team covers a lot of different parts of the company. We're software developers and data scientists and marketing and commercial professionals and HR and people ops. And so some folks were able to very quickly adapt and work from home, and others who are essential workers who actually test and manufacture the products had to come in during a very scary time. And so, you know, as a founder and as an entrepreneur, creating an environment where those team members would feel safe and going on eBay and trying to buy PPE so that we could keep the manufacturing facility going. I mean, it brought the team way closer together, and I'm forever grateful to our Echo Essential team members who rolled up their sleeves, put themselves at risk to come in and keep manufacturing critical products for healthcare providers. There's so many ways we will never go back to before, but certainly we'll never have the same lens and feeling as a team, as a healthcare ecosystem, because this year just opened our eyes to a lot.
Very well said. No, I think that's great. I agree. It's taking care of your people is very important when you're running a company and as a leader. So, but thank you so much. And really enjoy our conversation.
This was super fun. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, our content writer, Kelly Muscat, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. the Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.